Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. When you think of runners crossing the finish line, do you envision lean, muscular athletes who are so conditioned that running 26.2 miles doesn't seem to even faze them? Or do you envision folks with, I don't know, chafed, bleeding armpits, walking hunched, bow-legged, in a semi-delirious stupor? Joining us on the line to talk about what running a marathon can do to your body, from the well-oiled athlete to those out-of-shape bandit runners, is Dr. Doug Comeau. He's an assistant professor in family medicine, director of the BU's Primary Care Sports Medicine Fellowship. He practices at the Ryan Center for Sports Medicine at BU and the Orthopedic Clinic in Shapiro Ambulatory Care Center at BMC. Dr. Comeau, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
So what's the deal? Is a human body able to run a marathon without significant damage? Are we equipped for this?
Well, that's a great question. That's debated over time. And, you know, really, the people that we see in our medical tent more often than not are the people who are not equipped to run a marathon.
Because they haven't trained, or because why?
Well, because they haven't trained, and also the body itself is not really built to run 26.2 miles unless you train appropriately, but also at the same time, even if you do train appropriately, it can still break down with either muscle fatigue, a low sodium level, depending on the weather conditions, how you dress, and also how you pace yourself.
I mean, there are some outliers. There are some aberrations. And when you look at the bodies of the Kenyans, the Bill Rogers, the Alberto Salazars from
another
time, Johnny Kelly, decades and decades ago, there are some people who were lucky enough to be built with bodies that sort of fit this kind of athletic endeavor, but they're the few, are they not?
That's correct.
Okay, so let's talk about everybody else, because we're not worried about the few. They can take care of themselves. Before we talk, well, we can do simultaneously. What are the major things one should worry about, and what are the precautions one takes in training to try to avoid them at the best of your ability?
Well, I think that most people who are interested in running a marathon, either for charity or just for pleasure, would be joining a team or actually going online and having a training program,
right?
Depending on what your access is. And those training programs will allow your body to train up to prepare for the 26.2 miles, because even a recreational runner who runs a total mileage of 15 miles per week is not fit to run the marathon unless they metabolically train up for that level.
So could you do the short version, design a program, I don't mean every single day, but to that average runner whose goal is to run one or two marathons in their lives, or maybe more if they're successful at the first couple, and their concern is 3.5 hours, 4 hours, just finishing, what are the basics that they've got to accomplish before marathon day?
Well, I think the basics would be the training program we see even for a short program. If you take Boston, for example, would start around December or even a little sooner than that, depending on how much they run on a day-to-day basis. And those runs would be essentially shorter runs during the course of the week and then a longer run on the weekends. And that way, those longer runs will build up over time and culminate approximately 3 weeks before the race, which would be a 21-miler, which is their last conditioning run. And then you taper down so the body can repair itself to prepare to run the 26.2 on race day.
So if you do that, and you're not, you know, really overweight or something, and you're a fit person, you can, without too much damage, continue to run marathons. I mean, you see a lot of people, doctor, you know this better than I do, who've run like 30 marathons over, you know, 15 years of their life. They keep going well into their 50s. Bill Rogers jokes that he hobbles now more than
he runs.
But
he says,
he's
yeah.
also 66, and he's run dozens and dozens of marathons. But you can do this, right, if you do
Absolutely.
It correctly?
You can do it if you do it correctly.
Okay.
That's correct. And I think that the training is one aspect, but then also on race day, knowing how your body responds to hydration issues and also the weather conditions.
Yeah.
We've seen in our medical – I've been working in the medical tent at the finish line for the Boston Marathon since 2004, and I remember in particular 1 year in 2006 when – It was one of our colder years, or pardon me, 2007, one of our colder years, one of our first runners that came in actually had heat illness because they had double-layered Under Armour and ended up having a core body temperature in the 103-degree range.
Oh, my gosh.
So knowing the conditions, and that person was from out of town and saw that it was cold and hadn't trained in a cold weather environment, So really knowing those things, and in particular how the body responds, is actually vitally important as well. So not just taking water on race day, taking also Gatorade or Powerade or electrolytes to help replenish, and alternating that per mileage stop will help keep your body hydrated and prevent hyponatremia or low sodium level.
We're talking to Dr. Doug Kamau. He's an assistant professor in family medicine, director of the BU Primary Care Sports Medicine Fellowship. But the flip side of that, doctor, is we've all heard stories about people drinking too much. I mean, the caution is make sure you drink, make sure you force yourself to drink. But then you hear people drink too much and their sodium thing gets out of balance, and that's dangerous. What's the risk in becoming overhydrated?
Well, the risk of being overhydrated is, in fact, what we call low sodium level or hyponatremia, and that could result in a symptom of having nausea, having a little dizziness, having some headache upon the completion of the race or in the middle of the race. So that's why a lot of times the water stations are now set up at different mileage markers, and also the electrolyte stations are at different mileage markers. So if you're able to alternate that and replete some sodium alternating with water, it leads to less overhydration or in the sense of the water level.
You know what I wonder about, Dr. Kamau, is that pavement versus concrete versus dirt. I mean, the marathon in Boston, people are running on the pavement. But I always heard that was better than concrete, which is the sidewalk, but worse, of course, than dirt.
Well, that's correct. That's a great question. I think that when we look at people who accrue stress injuries and other musculoskeletal conditions, the pavement's actually better than concrete, mainly because concrete, it's not even the entire way through. But as far as dirt goes, a lot of the minimalist running studies for people who either do barefoot or minimalist running originated in the dirt and also in the western part of the U.S.
You know, Dr. Kamau, when you talk about the sodium issues and other kinds of things, ultimately you recover from those. Every once in a while you read these horrible stories about a totally fit human being who has no history of heart attacks or whatever in their family and their own personal medical records, who just drops dead on the course. When you hear those kinds of things, I assume, what's your reaction, and what should we know, if anything, about those, or should we just say it's sad and move on?
Well, sudden cardiac arrest is actually a risk factor in running a marathon. And, you know, again, I think it's a multifactorial thing where somebody, even though they don't have a family history, they could have underlying medical conditions. So, you know, if you are planning on performing a marathon or running a marathon, it's recommended that you check in with your primary care physician first to, you know, at least have your vital signs checked and, you know, have a general checkup. In addition, you know, from a preventative medicine standpoint, too, we recommend that all runners write their weight down pre-race, as well as writing down any medical conditions that they may have or their any medicines or allergies they have, so that when they're seeing the medical tent, they can have prompt medical attention for that.
Where do they write it down?
They can write it down on the back of their bib.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Dr. Kamau, what about carbo-loading? Are we still into carbo-loading, or is that bad?
Great question, and there are different theories out, and you know, you read different things in Runner's Magazine and also the sports medicine literature. But you know, I would say that carbo loading is still out there, you know, as far as pre-treating, because that'll allow you to burn off that energy as you prepare for race day.
Dr. Kamau, I've been carbo loading 365 days a year, and I'm not running. Is that? I had, just in case I might end up running. You know, we're talking to Dr. Doug Kamau, obviously, about marathon preparation. What is recovery? What does it actually mean to have your body recover? What has physiologically happened to you, assuming you successfully complete a marathon, that has to get fixed? And how long does it take for the fixing to happen?
Great question. And again, if you look at but not the norm, like the Johnny Kellys of the world, where they can go run a marathon the following week, they don't need as much time to recover. But for us lay people, you want to make sure that physiologically your electrolytes are balanced again. Also, you have enough time for your muscles to heal. A lot of times when people train up for marathons, they could develop either shin splints, they could develop different type of ankle symptoms, knee symptoms, back symptoms, depending on their running style. You want your muscles to be able to heal, so you could still cross-train, you know, in the elliptical, the bike, the swimming pool after a race for about like 1 to 2 weeks, and then you can get back to running.
Okay, let's discuss a hypothetical person. Marjorie, please stay out of this, okay? A hypothetical person, let's say, for argument's sake, ran the New York City Marathon twice in the 1980s.
Okay.
Now,
he
this
always
person
brings this up.
Now, this hypothetical person trained adequately, followed all the books, bought Runner's World, bought Jim Fix's book at the time, another guy who dropped dead running, I should say.
He had a bad history.
I understand that. And here's what happened, and this is a true story. This particular person trained at a certain rate. The fastest he had ever run a single mile was X. He ran 26.2 miles at a rate of below X on marathon day because of all the excitement and all the crowds. And that person literally could not stand up straight for maybe a week to 10 days after, even though the joy was in his heart. That does happen. People get so jazz, so psyched, so moved by the mass of runners and the mass of the crowd that they really do push themselves more than they should. But the worst that happens is you suffer some pain after the fact, right?
Absolutely. And I think that the adrenaline is definitely a factor in any sport. And being part of the thousands, tens of thousands of people with a crowd that's cheering you on is going to push you through to the finish line. In addition, if that hypothetical person trained in Boston, it's a lot hillier in Boston, so in theory, your time would go down in New York because it's a flat marathon.
Yeah.
It is a flat marathon, except when you get to Central Park for this hypothetical
person. Enough about this hypothetical person. I have one more question for you, Dr.
Sure.
Comeau. If you're just looking for, you want to be healthy, you want to keep in shape, get your blood pressure down, cholesterol down, weight down, all those kinds of things, you can do that by running a lot less, right?
Yes, absolutely.
What is a good, if you're saying to a person, 30 years old, 40 years old, whatever, they want to start a running program, what do you say? Like 15 miles a week? What's the deal?
Well, I think that when we do our exercise prescriptions for patients here at our sports medicine clinic for more preventative nature, we recommend that people would exercise at least 3 times per week, potentially 5 times per week. And they would go for a minimum of 20 minutes to 30 minutes on the treadmill or outside. And during that time, they would try to get their max predicted heart rate up to 85%. So what we do with an exercise prescription is take their age, take into account their running ability, and then tell them their mileage and also what pace they should do.
Okay.
But let me ask a naive question, though, to close it. Why don't, but I'm in one of these rare phases in my life where I actually have been exercising for a while that follows long phases where I've done nothing.
Another hypothetical person.
No, this is not hypothetical in this case. This is really me. Everybody knows how helpful exercise is. Why is it that the vast majority of our fellow citizens just don't do it? What's the psychological or physical block? And how do you overcome it, I guess?
Well, I think it's hard when you see athletes on TV or see the local news and seeing what people are doing and accomplishing that you can't be that person. And our frame of reference is more the television, especially with Boston being such a sports-driven city, they can't see themselves doing that because they were never taught that growing up. And, as much as we preach exercise, I think that even starting even a basic exercise prescription, parking in the parking garage, maybe far away from your office,
starting
to walk to work. And then that way, that in itself will start to train your body and you'll start to notice that you'll feel a lot better. I think that we have a lot of patients who don't do that, and then they come in and they're down and depressed, and they can't lose weight based on nutrition alone, because exercise is the biggest component of losing weight.
Dr.
Sounds good to me.
Are you a marathon runner?
Am I a marathon runner?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
See you at Falmouth in August, Doctor.
Thank you very much
Thanks,
for
doctor.
Joining us, Doctor. That was great.
Hey, no problem, man. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, absolutely. Dr. Doug Comeau is Assistant Professor in Family Medicine and Director of the Boston University Primary Care Sports Medicine Fellowship. He practices at the Ryan Center for Sports Medicine at BU and the Orthopedic Clinic in Shapiro Ambulatory Care Center at Boston Medical Center. Okay, when we come back, we're going to ask you what you think at 877-301-8970. Are these marathoners all nuts? I mean, would you really want to go out there and run 26 miles, even if you did train well? And what do you think today in marathon the marathon day in general. It's a special one, obviously. We'll take your calls coming back at 877-301-8970.
Today on WGBH Radio and WGBHnews.org, the Boston Marathon. More runners than ever before in WGBH News will be there, from Hopkinton to Copley, on air and online at WGBHnews.org.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Solitary Nation from WGBH's Frontline. Get an intimate view of solitary confinement through the eyes of inmates and officers. Don't miss Frontline, Solitary Nation, Tuesday at 10 on WGBH 2.
In Tennessee, the number of babies born to drug-addicted mothers has been soaring. Lawmakers are putting their feet down.
What's wrong with you screwed up, you're wrong, you got to pay the consequences? What's wrong with that?
Some worry that a tough new law will deter some pregnant women from getting help. That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Public Radio from Boston for New England. I'm Callie Crossley, and you're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston, online at WGBHnews.org. Boston Public Radio.
Okay, it's your turn. This is Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie again at 877-301-8970. Marjorie put it delicately. She said, are these people crazy? Considering the damage one does, apparently just temporarily, to one's body, you have to be crazy to run a 26.2. This year, there's special reasons. I think we're talking in general. And secondly, it is obviously an anniversary of a horror, and so far it's gone along quite beautifully. Spirits seem to be incredibly high. The weather is beautiful. What's your sense of the 118th Boston Marathon in this day? At 877-301-8970. You know, last Friday I interviewed Amby Burfoot. I don't know if you know who he is, Marjorie. He won the marathon in 68. He's the oldest winner to be running today. He's 67 years old, I believe. By the way, you know who his roommate was in college at Wesleyan?
Who?
Bill Rogers. Amby Burfoot won the Boston Marathon in 1968. His roommate, Bill Rogers, did not win till 7 years later, 1975.
So wait a minute,
and won three more times.
Did they start running together at Wesleyan?
Well, Amby Burfoot, who went on essentially to be the force behind Runner's World, which is essentially the Bible of runners, the magazine, and now he's a senior editor or something. Apparently, Burfoot was always a good runner, I think. And my recollection is having them both tell me, I had Rogers on the week before, that he was a sort of middling two-miler in high school. And then all of a sudden, he and Burfoot hooked up, and it became great. You know what Burfoot is doing today? By the way, he's in the third wave, which means he starts at least, I think, an hour behind everybody else. This is a champion from 68. He printed up on his own. He gave me one the other night. He printed up these cards that he is handing out. He printed up about 200 of them. He's handing out along the route. Thank you, Boston Marathon fans, for your 118 years of support for all runners, fast and slow alike. Without you, the marathon wouldn't be the amazing race that we cherish so much. And then it has a bunch of all the cities and towns through which it goes. We love you all. Thanks for giving us the thrills of a lifetime. See you again next year. Amby Burfoot, 1968 Boston Marathon.
Terrific.
By the way, he literally, you can see they're primitive. He printed them, he got them printed up himself, paid for a couple hundred, and wanted to hand them out just to show some appreciation. 877-301-8970. What's your impression of the day? How do you feel on the day? There'll never be another marathon day like this, needless to say. At least we hope there'll never be another day like this. Look at this this guy now crossing the finish line. One leg with two crutches. I don't know who it is. I don't know if that person at all was involved in, obviously, last year's terror, but it's a pretty amazing, amazing
sight. Wow, he's really moving along at quite a clip on those crutches.
He is. He is indeed. Looks quite strong. 877-301-8970. So what's your takeaway from this day? What are you going to remember? First of all, an American won the mail race for the first time, I think, since 1983. His name is Meb. I love that name. Meb Kafleski is his name. And the woman who won the race won last year as well. She is Rita Jebtu. She won the marathon, the Boston Marathon, last year and in 2006, which is really pretty amazing. She's from Kenya. There was a seven-year split. And for a while there, a United States woman has not won the woman's race since 1985. This woman, Shalane Flanagan, who you know grew up in Marblehead, went to Marblehead High School.
I know, we were all rooting for her.
She trained in Kenya. She was fourth last year. I don't know what she ended up coming in this year. She trained in Kenya because obviously the vast majority of the great elite runners, male and female, are from Kenya. And she trained there and was leading the race until, I don't know, 17 miles in. And then all of a sudden faded. And she did finish. But
they went out really fast. The women went out really, really fast. And that may have been because she was leading for a long time. And you always say, gee, it's nice to have someone breaking the wind in front of you, you know, so you're not the first person into the wind. You can be behind the person.
But it's all strategic, right? I mean, they all have the – I assume it's part of your – it's a mind game as well as a physical game.
Most of us don't know, of course, about leading the race. We're always way back in the pack, so you don't have to worry about leading.
Yeah, well, I've been bragging about having run two marathons when I was, let's put it this way, a little bit younger.
Right.
And by the way, the photograph of me crossing the finish line at the New York City Marathon is on our Facebook page now, brought in by Irene. If you go to the Boston Public Radio Facebook page, our colleague Abby – who is home today, texted me a couple of minutes ago and says, quite a fro, Jim. And I had quite a fro on that particular day. It is really, it's a wildly exciting thing, but it takes a huge, first of all, huge commitment to get ready for marathon day.
You have
day
to run a lot.
For a long time. And it takes, how are you? Marjorie let me know that she was the third woman. Where was that marathon?
I can't believe I didn't brag about
that
before.
Where was
that? It was in Lake Champlain Island Marathon in Burlington, Vermont.
Okay, so you came in third.
Like
what kind of physical condition? As I described a couple of minutes ago to the sports doctor from BU, I literally, and I'm not kidding, could not stand up straight for a week, but I didn't care.
Yep.
It didn't matter how much pain it was. I was so proud of myself. What kind of? You're much more of an athlete than I, needless to say. What kind of shape are you in?
Finished
after
the race.
You finished.
Had a beer and a cigarette.
Not.
I did. I used to smoke then.
That is great.
And my best friend from high school, who is a better athlete than I am, she was a big star. She ran in Boston a bunch of times, and she smoked about
half a pack a day. But how'd you feel other than having
your thighs hurt.
Do you remember the feeling? I do.
What you can't do is stand up very well. The next day, you get out of your chair, and it takes you a while to straighten out your quadriceps, because that's sort of the irony, is that the running downhill can take a toll on your quadriceps.
I agree. Can I tell one last thing about this before we get to the calls at 877-301-8970? And it's basically all things marathon today. It's obviously a pretty important day in the history of Boston and for all people who are watching, and that's pretty much eyes all across this country and many throughout the world. The thing that is so great about marathons that is not said nearly enough, I believe, and I asked Rogers and Burfoot both this question, maybe you could tell me if I'm wrong, they didn't think I was, is there any other world-class athletic event anywhere where the weekend warrior gets to compete with the greatest two or three or five athletes in that sport in the world? I don't think there is.
Well,
I mean, you get to run with the best people at their craft. It's
Rogers
amazing.
Also says, and it's so true, it is such a simple sport. You know, you need your sneakers.
Yeah.
So anywhere you go, you can go out and run. And it's just very simple. All you need is a good pair of shoes. And I think when you get good at it, you feel like they talk about the runner's high, that, you know, your body turns into like this little running machine. And it's really kind of neat. These days, I don't think I could run half a mile, but once upon a time, I could run a long way.
The key for me was the fro, by the way. It wasn't the training. It was the fro being in its proper stage, or I just couldn't even get across the finish line.
Beautiful fro, Jim.
Okay, let's go to Brian in a car. You were first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you so much for the call. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thanks for taking it.
Pleasure.
I have a lot of feelings about today, but I guess the main one is I ran a few marathons in the past, and so I have an idea what runners go through, but one thing that I loved today was that two of the people for whom America's national anthem was played are immigrants to this country.
Yes.
Kefli Yazee for the men and Tatiana McFadden, the wheelchair winner. And
I wasn't aware. Where is she from? Where is she born?
I think she was born in Russia.
I didn't know that.
Was around six when she was adopted. Mm-hmm. I think around six when she was adopted
Great.
By the McFadden family in this country. So. And to see their faces as American citizens and great athletes was wonderfully inspiring. And then Shalane Flanagan also, who did not win and wanted to very, very badly, the courage of the race that she ran was also spectacularly inspiring. And her desire, what she wanted was the olive wreath. And that, you know, that goes back to the beginnings of the sport. So there was just so much about today as a, and I'm a Bostonian and a runner and an American, and it was all just absolutely wonderful.
Let me read you. I'm so glad you brought up Flanagan, who we mentioned before. Grew up in Marblehead. She went to Marblehead High School. Here's the quote saying exactly what you mentioned. This is before the race. If I could have one wish, it would be to win this specific race on this specific day. It basically would be the highlight of my career for sure. If I could win this specific Boston, and it has the most power, the most meaning behind it of all the Boston marathons that would be run.
Yeah,
and she really went for it. If people weren't watching this race,
she led
for what, 16, 17 miles thereabouts, right?
Yeah, and that is out in front of a pack of runners. She, to some extent, is breaking the wind for them. They're grafting effort. So,
Brian,
I mean, it was wonderfully courageous. Yeah.
I wonder, we were talking about the toll the marathon takes on the body. Now, you say you've run several marathons when you were younger. How do you feel? Do you feel like you've had permanent damage? Do you think you're okay?
No, I'm fine.
Yeah.
I'm a pretty big guy. For most of the ones I ran, I did do an adequate amount of training, and in, at that point, I had the sense you go out and run the next day. You run 2 miles very slowly, and in a few days you feel fine. But I think I'm lucky. I've got very tight joints. I wasn't prone to spraining things, and I'm also slow as molasses, so I didn't push myself the way these great runners do. You know, I survived, and I'm proud of the times that I ran for somebody built the way I am. And
we can tell you're proud. The pride comes through, Brian. Thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
It is a great thing. You can say for the rest of your life. You know what I mean? You can brag at a cocktail party for the rest of your life. Oh, well, you know.
That's interesting. Marjorie
ran a marathon or two.
Talks about bragging at a cocktail party. She talks about how she finished third in this Burlington Marathon. She went and had a beer and a cigarette. And somebody who might know about both those things is now joining us. Edgar B. Herwick III is joining us live from Kenmore Square. Edgar, what's going on out there?
More cowbell. That's what's going on out here. A lot of runners coming to me. It's just been a constant stream for at least the last hour of runners coming through. The crowd just erupting in support every time somebody comes by. And cowbell after cowbell after cowbell. It's a beautiful sunny day, and the spirits are actually really high right here in Kenmore Square. We're, of course, about a mile from the finish line here, so this is like the final stretch and the final push.
You know, Edgar, there was some talk before about the crowds not being quite so big. Obviously, that's not your impression in Kenmore Square. It's pretty packed there.
I wouldn't say packed. I would say that it's busy. There's a lot of people here. There's definitely a crowd, but it's by no means an overwhelming crowd. And it should be noted right now, it looks like the Red Sox game is letting out or starting to let out. We saw some earlier crowds from the Red Sox game, but I'm looking up the hill now, and a lot of people coming out of Fenway Park. But security has walked off the street here so that you can't just walk out of the park and straight down to the race area at Kenmore. So that's a little bit different than prior years. They're being very careful with how they're shuffling the crowd along there. So we're not getting that extra swell of crowd coming out of Fenway Park down here into the area where the race is happening.
Now, Edgar, we've been talking about athletes, and we know you're a big athlete. You're a great dancer. You do those Lindy competitions and everything.
Thank you, Marjorie.
You're welcome. But are you inspired now watching these runners? Do you think it's going to be Edgar in sneakers to run next year, or is it just you stick it with the dancing?
Well, you don't want to accomplish all of your life's goals too quickly, Marjorie. So I don't know that I'm going to run it just yet, but maybe I'll hold it out for some time in the future. But no, in all seriousness, every year this marathon, you're reminded, it's one of the great things about this event is you come out and you see these people who are doing the near impossible, or so it seems, right?
Yeah.
They're running 26.2 miles, and you see all types at this point, a mile from the finish. You see some people just totally strong, just killing it with 1 mile left. You see people fighting off cramps. I've seen people walking and then start running again and everything. And the crowd here, I think, really knows that. And there's this big moment where any runner that comes by that seems to be, you know, fading a little bit or cramping, they get a huge cheer from the crowd to get them over that last hump and get them that last mile. And it's impressive to see this many people in this amazing shape just finishing this race. Really, it's inspiring.
You know, one of the things that's also inspiring is, I've said this many a time before, tomorrow morning is the day when you see every out-of-shape Bostonian on the Charles. The weather's going to be great. Everybody's inspired by, no, I'm serious, by today. And they're going to be doing, you know, one of the interesting things is going to be, you know, we spoke to Emily Rooney at the at noon, right when the male runner was crossing the finish line, Edgar, and she said she didn't think the crowds were as packed as she's seen them in the past, and you're saying similar things. I'm wondering if it's a function, and I'm betting it is, of security precautions that are being taken by the Boston police and their allies, or if it's because people didn't turn out in the same sort of numbers that that we expected. You think security has something to do with it?
I think security has something to do with it. I mean, there's definitely, well, I wouldn't call it overwhelming, but I would say there's a marked, noticeable security presence here, and more noticeable than in previous years. But, you know, Jim, I talked to a couple of runners a few minutes ago who finished the race and made their way back up here towards Fenway Park. And they said that what they experienced, they both run the race previous time. They said that they thought the crowds along the race route, all told, were bigger than they'd ever experienced.
So oh,
their
good.
Experience from good. The runner's experience, what I heard is that the crowds were bigger.
Good.
We hope that is the case. We're speaking to Edgar B. Herwick III, who is at live at Kenmore Square. What you're seeing now, and this is one of my favorite parts of the race, I assume we're, what, 3 hours and 21 minutes into what is called, I think, the third wave, which is sort of the amateurs.
Yeah,
the
started at 11.
The runners who qualified, right, which, so, and we see a few people walking, too, down Boylston Street. What's the, other than happiness, what kind of, are people walking where you are? Some of them walking, some of them running. What's going on?
Edgar's gone.
Oh, Edgar, he's gone. Well, then I'll answer it myself. Some are walking and some are running.
You know, Edgar, thanks.
Edgar B. Herwick III from the Curiosity Desk joined us live from Kenmore Square.
Lots of times, by the time you get to mile 20 or 21, no matter how well you train, you've got blisters, you've got cramps, you've got things chafing against each other, you've got
how great
does
finishing feel, though, no matter how you do, when you feel the sense of accomplishment, is it, even if you didn't come in third like you did.
For the rest of your life, you can say, I did it. So that's always fun.
Marjorie was at
the
25-mile mark up there in Burlington. She said, only 1.2 more miles and I can have a cigarette and a beer.
Nice.
877-301
8970. Well, I was young then, Jim. You know what I mean? Young and irresponsible, as George Bush would say. 877-301-8970. So do you think these people are crazy for running this race? Do you feel a certain kind of heightened? I mean, we've said this earlier today, and I'll say it again now, that, you know, the marathon was always a great event in Boston, a big road race, get a lot of world-class runners in here, great family day. But obviously, it's different this year. And how do you feel about it this year as opposed to in previous years? John Nucci wrote a great little piece in the Herald today where he admitted what lots of us didn't want to admit this year because we thought it was in poor taste, but he admitted, you know, that he was kind of a crank about the marathon. You know, oh my God, there's going to be paper cups everywhere and all this tax dollars picking up the paper cups.
Traffic issues.
Traffic, and you can't get around the city as well. And I complained about that previously because I live right off of Beacon Street and you can only get on Beacon Street one way and it's kind of a pain in the neck and you had to drive all the way out to Framingham.
Got to take the pike.
To get to NECN one time because everything is blocked off, but no one is complaining this year. It's a much different feel. David from Lowell, what do you think about today's marathon? Are these people crazy, David, to run so far?
Hey, David.
No, that's the kind of craziness that most people would be very happy to have.
Amen.
Running
I agree.
Running is high, let me tell you.
Yeah.
I win every race I finish. I ran my first Boston in 1964.
Wow.
Jack Purcell sneakers, a bathing suit, and a ripped-up sweatshirt, and I had never run it before. The furthest I'd ever run my whole life was the previous Sunday. I ran 13 miles from Waltham to Maynard.
That is great.
So I did 20 miles, and I'm there. I'm in Heartbreak Hill. You know, it's a series of hills, and the last one is sort of a convex hill.
Yes.
So the bus was there, and it's one of those crappy days in New England, you know, with sleet and all that stuff. I said, okay, that's enough. I got on the bus. I gets up over the hill, and I said, oh, my God. Had I only known it's at the top of the hill, I should have kept on going.
So, David, in 1964, how many people were in Copley Square at the finish line?
I don't know. They used to finish at the Lenox Hotel.
Oh, the Lenox, wherever it was. So a couple
of
blocks.
Yeah, there were quite a few.
Really? Even then?
But the interesting part is in 64, there were only 200 entrants, and I thought that was a lot of people. The next year, there were 400. I said, oh, my God, where is this thing going? You know,
so
it's gone far beyond that.
David, so what was it? Was it Jim Fix's book, The Book of
Running
that changed everything?
Or
was it Bill Rogers?
I've read it over and over again. It's my Bible.
But what changed? All of a sudden, because you're right, when I used to run, I mean, even in the 70s, there weren't that many people, or the 80s, there weren't that many people.
Can I answer the question?
What?
Four things. Runner's World, Jim Fix's book, Bill Rogers and Frank Shorter from Yale. Those they became Shorter and Rogers became superstars. All of a sudden, people started talking about becoming fit. I think for the first time, at least in our lifetime, spurred on by Runner's World and Jim Fix. Don't you think that's what did it, David?
Oh yeah, sure it is. There's always someone like that. In fact, I'll give you an idea. Back when I was running in the early '60s. We had a running friend of mine, Marty Cavanaugh from Waltham. They had a memorial race to him. He was in his 60s. I got him his number because back then, if you were over 60, you were not allowed to run. So I'd go into John Temple's office in North Station. I'd buy the number, buy the membership to BAA, and that's how he'd run. But
great
if he's
story.
Running around the reservoir in Cambridge by Taunton Pond Road and Winter Street, that used to be one of our training routes, he'd get picked up by the police. Someone thought he escaped from Trapler Road.
David, before you go, the reason they wouldn't give numbers to people older than 60 is they were worried that they would die on the course or something?
Yeah, exactly.
Great.
In fact, the physical then, listen to the physical, they would take you out. Because you used to, sometimes if you were lucky, you got a covered bus, but you used to have those half, the buses in Boston with no roofs on them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And God help you, if it was one of those crappy days, and you'd be drenched and frozen by the time you got there. But they marched you into Hopkinton High School, they weighed you, and they took your pulse. If your pulse was more than 60, they didn't allow you to run. They figured you hadn't been training.
Hey, David,
really?
You should write something or do an audio history. Those are great stories. Thanks for sharing them with us. David ran his first one in 1964.
Boy, you might be so nervous.
200 people running in the race.
200 people, yeah.
Was it 36,000 today?
36,000. It's a little bit of a different atmosphere. Let's go.
You know, by the way, you're jokingly asking people, is it worth it because of the physical toll? There aren't many things you do in your listen to the two of us, by the way.
No,
I ran two decades ago. It's two of the proudest things in my life. Same with you, right?
No, I know.
Mean, it's huge.
Like I said, you can always say you've done it. It's
and especially add to that, neither of us ran Boston. Can you imagine? Had you run Boston?
I did.
What happened to you?
Well, I moved to Vermont, and it was very difficult to run when
Come
it was like
here.
10 degrees below zero. And so my...
Oh, you mean to train?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was very hard to train. Actually, I was amazed that people could train this winter, but times have changed so much and become so much more sophisticated that a lot of people had these elaborate regimes that they did in the gym because when it's zero, you know, when you try to run when it's 0 degrees, the air hurts your throat. It's very painful. So, but now they have the ellipticals or whatever they are that go uphill. All that stuff, they didn't used to have that.
I think the technical term is ellipticals that go uphill is what I think the expression is. Is that what you're talking
Back
about?
Back in the dark ages, they didn't have that kind of stuff.
Ellipticals that go uphill.
Maureen from Concord. What do you think, Maureen?
Hey, Maureen.
Hey, Marjorie. Hey, Jim.
Hi.
I'm a first-time caller.
Well, we're very glad. Thank you.
And I'm not a groupie, so you should be honored.
We are honored. Honored.
Go ahead, Maureen.
I want to tell you that... one of the things that, all right, there are a few things I want to say. First of all, my husband was an inspiration to me into running. So I was a new young teacher at a public school in Bedford. He was the coach, and he had really nice legs, and he was a great runner. And in 1982, he ran 226 at Boston.
Wow.
You know,
wow.
It gave you a great place, but he was so good. So I was looking at this cute guy with nice legs thinking, and like you, Marjorie, I was smoking a bit then.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, maybe I could run and maybe I could. So I started to train with his team and I learned about running and I actually got pretty good at it. And I ran Boston a few times. My best was 3:05.
Oh.
You are fast, Maureen. That is fast.
But anyway, the point of my call really is about connections through running because I've met some of the most wonderful people we both have in our lives through running. And I don't think that, you know, we're in our late 50s. My husband's 64 now. You don't really appreciate what you can do physically until it's kind of past, you know?
Yeah.
And, but we still, even now, we have a couple of friends from Colorado staying with us. Because they opened a running store. He's a former student of my husband.
That's great.
He coached him. And they're here to watch the marathon, you know?
No, that's
you know,
great.
You know, Maureen, I live
great
near,
first call, Maureen.
Near Marathon Sports on Beacon Street, not the one down by the finish line, but another one on Beacon Street. And you see on Sunday mornings dozens of people. They all get together and they take off from marathon sports and they go off running. And some of them are really, you know, good runners with a really fast pace. And some of them are just, you know, they're joggers practically. But they do it every week and they're running and they're talking. And I'm always thinking to myself, I should get myself down there one of these days. I never do. But the friendships, you're absolutely right. It's and people travel from road race to road race, right?
It's incredible. Even I have three children, and two of my children actually had a friend of mine that I met through running, because we were very serious at one time, training, you know, to try to make the first Olympic trials for women.
Wow.
I didn't. But she was with me when I had two of my children. She was like my doula or my midwife. You know what I mean? I mean, and she's the godmother to my daughter. Connections are incredible.
So, Maureen, if you're running a 3:05 marathon, what was your fastest mile? I got to know.
Well, I did the Bay State Games at one time.
Yeah.
I was probably like 5:20. I tried all the distances, but I think I was about a 5:20. Yeah,
okay. Well, that's what she's interested
that's
in. Maureen,
fast.
Before you go, what
that
I want to know, what all the listeners want to know, how are his legs today?
Well, that's quite... I'll tell you the truth. I live in Concord, as you know, and today I walked the 10K loop while the Minutemen and the Fife Drum people were, like, tooting their horns and all that. And I was grateful to be able to do that because I really can't run much right now. My back's not so great.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, but I'm not losing hope.
Never forget that 3:05. Have Maureen, great first call. Do it again soon. We really appreciate it.
Well, you know, a lot of people, you know how a lot of people I knew started running distances in college? To cure hangovers. That was like the big thing. You run.
This is unbelievable.
You run like
Marjorie
six,
smokes
8 miles.
And has a beer when she finishes third in Burlington. Her friends run to cure hangovers.
Well,
there's a whole different school.
Don't think that's unusual. I think that was a way to start because you get far enough and your hangover is cured. Okay, are we moving on?
Yeah, but let's just say, if people tuned in, it's a special 3-hour edition of Boston Public Radio. Let's just say who the primary winners were today. Tatiana McFadden, who we were told by a caller a few minutes ago, was born in Russia, came here as a little girl. Her 25th birthday is today. She won the women's wheelchair division. And Ernst, or I don't know if it's Ernst, I think it's how it's pronounced, Van Dyke, who's from South Africa, won his 11th Boston Marathon in the men's wheelchair division. And the women, Rita Jeptu, second Boston championship in 2 years. She's from Kenya. And Mev Kafleski, I hope I'm getting it right, first American man to win a Boston Marathon since 1983, born in Eritrea, and he came here as a 12-year-old. He ran out of San Diego, and he is, the first male American winner of the marathon for 31 years. That's pretty incredible, isn't it?
It is pretty incredible.
How happy? I mean, one of the great things, I know this is probably the case in almost all races, the looks on the faces of the four winners we just mentioned. I mean, the sense of it is really so electric. It is just... It's really, really great. And people are still running.
They are.
And they're still finishing, and there are a lot of smiles on a lot of faces.
A great picture WBC's got on now, the people coming down Hereford Street and just going
crossing
around the corner
Boylston,
there.
Crossing onto Boylston,
onto Boylston.
It's great.
Really, it's really
congratulations
neat.
To them all.
Okay. If you have an appetite, you got to stay tuned, because up next we're going to talk to food writer Corby Kummer. He joins us for his recommendations on what restaurants marathoners should head to after crossing the finish line, anybody who's heading down toward the finish line. That is next. The best places to eat in Copley Square on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Marathon Monday on WGBH Radio. Voices of Runners.
I'm not going to let them or anybody else defeat my spirit of running.
I'm a runner. I like to run. I got very lucky, and I'm going to be running Boston this year.
And our voices who are covering the day.
Philip Martin.
Anne Mostu.
Edgar B. Herwig III.
Jared Bowen.
Today on 89.7 WGBH.
Boston.
Boston.
Boston Public Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you. And Seasons 4, for 44 years, the outdoor living store on Mass Ave in Lexington, featuring over 100 styles of furniture and a large selection of plants, statuary, and garden accessories. April event now in progress. Seasons4.com. And Subaru of New England, offering the new Subaru XV Crosstrek Hybrid with symmetrical all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at SubaruofNewEngland.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, special three-hour edition of our show today, obviously on Marathon Day. I'm Jim Brown. She's Marjorie Egan. Joining us online because the marathon route has effectively trapped him in JP is Corby Kummer. Corby, as you know, is here to offer a restaurant guide for out-of-towners and marathoners who are no doubt in search of food and drink, and in Marjorie's case, a cigarette. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic and an award-winning food writer. Hey, Corby, how are you?
Jim, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Hey, Corby, I made a mistake before. We're not just talking about Copley Square where the race ends. We're talking about a bunch of places on all around the marathon route. So give us a couple of your faves, Corby.
Okay, so let's start at the epicenter, which is Copley Square. So there's a new place that will give us a segue to talk about what happens tomorrow, which is called Sweet Green. Have either of you been there? It's one of those assemble your own salad with impeccably fresh and locally sourced ingredient places.
Ooh.
Sounds fabulous.
Not only is it fabulous because the greens and the vegetables are so fresh, but it's got that untreated wood that looks like it came from a barn on a farm 40 miles away just yesterday, and a blackboard with the names of the local farms everything comes from. What I find very interesting about the business model is it was started by four friends from Georgetown who, in their mid-20s, have created this very successful chain. They started in Washington. I think they've got at least 17 locations, and they're in New York and Boston. But every place they go, they have locally sourced greens and ingredients and good wraps and various things. But it's really the sandwiches are the star. It's right there at Copley Place. And I think just a very interesting small business model, young people who are entrepreneurs and going to capture the market that wants everything local and fresh.
By the way, I've never heard anybody use the verb assemble for a salad before you,
yeah.
But I like it. It makes the salad sound so much more appealing than it would otherwise sound. Is there something special to an assembly of a salad, or is just...
I think that anyone who prides her or himself as much as I and many cooks who specialize in salads do would always use the word assemble. You're
right.
Just coming late to this. I mean, it requires such careful thought about every component that goes into it. And you get to do it while the extremely bright young people who are probably going to get PhDs are helping you do it.
Sounds great to me.
But it's not like a salad bar, is it, or is it?
No, you don't do it yourself.
Okay, they
do
it for
you. You have to order it and you point to things. They have a bunch of possible combinations, and you get to mix and match.
Oh, I love this idea.
So, Corby, let's come back to tonight for a second. You finish the race. You're walking relatively well. You feel exuberant, as I assume most of the finishers do. Assuming you could get into the places that would be at the top of your list, what would be and why? Where would you, if they called you and said, where should I go tonight to celebrate this great personal triumph and this great day in Boston, what would be your top couple of places?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm thinking in terms of what's easy for everybody to walk to.
Okay, that's fine. I mean, that's one of the criteria, I assume.
You know, what you can walk to is illegal seafood, which I point every out-of-towner to when they come here. And there's the one right at Prudential. There's the one at Park Place. Mm-hmm. They're both beautifully run. They're unusually diverse in a town where restaurants are not as diverse as they should be. Service is great, and, of course, impeccable seafood. So that, I think, is like Boston flying its banners and Boston at its best. For more local and small and celebratory, there's a place right on Mass Ave at the top of Comm Ave at the end of Back Bay called Asta, A-S-T-A, which is kind of fancy food in that it is chef-made. It's very personal, uses lots of local ingredients, and even though it's simple and looks bare bones, it's definitely a special occasion kind of a place. And I've never sent anybody there who's been unhappy. Very local model and really good. As far as, you know, and if you want great pizza, I'm just trying to think of where I would go. If you want a carb load,
yes.
You walk across the MIT Bridge, go up toward Kendall Square and go to Area 4 pizza. Or you walk instead to the Greenway, and right next to South Station, Jody Adams's Trade, Both places, Michael Leviton at Area 4 in Cambridge and Jody at Trade in Boston, right on the waterfront, they have the same terrific wood-burning pizza oven, and they're both doing great things with pizza dough. And they would both tell you that they worked for months on the best pizza dough on the planet. You know, they're different pizza doughs. You can go and decide after your carb loading whose is the best.
Hey, Corby, before you continue, we're talking to Corby Cummer, by the way. Would any of the higher-end restaurants you mentioned turn away? Let's assume a marathon runner comes in, and he or she has those Mylar sheets on. They're wearing shorts and sneakers. Would they let them in, or would they say you're not appropriately attired?
Would do anything but say that they're honored to have the runners as guests.
Wait, they would or they wouldn't? I missed the beginning of that sentence.
They would be thrilled.
Oh, they would.
Of course.
So Mylar is okay on this one night. What's that?
Sorry?
Mylar is okay on this particular night?
I think Mylar, you know, Mylar is a look anyway. But Mylar today is a badge of honor. Everybody's incredibly excited to welcome somebody in Mylar.
Okay, so where else? Where else? You've got some places in Brookline, too.
Oh, my goodness, Brookline. So walk, keep going up. And I hope that everybody today who was anywhere near Washington Square, which is evidently one of the only places you can cross the street, would go to Athens. I've watched the marathon from Athens. Athens is one of my favorite cafes and bakeries in the whole country.
Oh, I love it, too. Tell people what they've got inside Athens. They've got such delicious sweets.
So it's actually run by this marvelous, incredibly literate Greek couple. She's an immigrant rights lawyer, but they've thrown themselves into this. It's incredibly elegant, old-fashioned French, as in just better than what you get, and better and less fancy and pretentious. Real kind of French European pastries, by which I mean cakes and layer cakes and the kind of things you dream of getting in a Viennese cafe, presented in a very unpretentious but beautiful and slightly formal European atmosphere. By the way, it is a great place for first and blind dates.
You are right.
I have met many people
legendary
who have chosen it for their blind date rendezvous. It also has great tea cookies and these wonderful, not too rich shortbreads that make me hungry just thinking of it, as well as these Greek healthful walnut cookies in light sugar syrup that aren't too sweet, but will just spoil you for anything else, and homemade baklava. And great hot chocolate. So that is a great place. It's right on the route. So what is across the street from there? One of the most exciting and pioneering new restaurants that is going to put, that is already putting Boston on a national food mecca map. It's called Ribelle.
Yes.
R-I-B-E-L-L-E. It's opened by Tim Maslow, who made a huge splash when he came back from New York and the Momofuku Empire, which is David Chang's TV starring Asia fusion, incredibly well-known restaurant. And Tim puts his own spin on this. Ribelle is all Italian. It's his version of Italian. But that means it's got lots of Asia in it. And it is just some of the most genuinely exciting food anywhere right now.
Hey, Corby, are you assembling a salad in a wood bowl as you're talking to us or not?
No, it's something I often do when I'm on the phone.
Oh, okay.
I don't happen to be doing it right now, but, you know, I might have to, in your honor.
Okay, now we're talking to Corby Cummer. Corby, one of the things I worry about when you raise people's expectations, and when you talk about food, you make it sound like it's sitting in front of you and I can picture it. But can anybody get in any place? If you don't have a reservation to any of these places, and it's marathon night where the 36,000 runners and their families and friends and people coming from outside Boston to view the festivities, and people who came to the morning baseball game. Can you get in any place tonight?
Who knows? I think what you have to do is go. For example, Legal is one of those places.
Yeah.
I think they give you those buzzers where you can go out and they'll ring you when it's time for your table.
You know what they say? They give you the buzz. They say, go run a marathon, and we'll buzz you. On the...
and we'll be ready for you.
Exactly.
But I think what they'd also say is, we have another location at Park Square. If you want to go to the waterfront, we have another location there. So they might have an idea of who's got more room and more capacity. Someplace like Asta, you know, one of the joys of eating in this town, or really any town, is every restaurant keeps open a number of tables for walk-ins. So whatever they say on the phone, it's going to be different when you show up. And tonight, when everything is so much in flux and it's Oh, yeah.
Really? So if you call them, they say, we're booked until 9:30, you should try to show up anyway?
Oh, of course. For example, when I was reviewing the new restaurant Zarma, which is in a fairly remote corner of Somerville, they say Union Square, but it's behind Union Square.
Uh-huh.
And the people who bought years ago, hoping the neighborhood would finally offer a restaurant like that, are incredibly thrilled and going three times a week. There's no way to get in there unless you just go to the bar. And the bar happens to be a third of the restaurant. It's a really happening place. Sarma is Turkish appetizers and street food from Turkey, opened by Anna Sorton of Oleana in Cambridge.
Oh,
that's an incredible
God.
Special occasion place, but you're going to have to take the subway or drive up 93 to get to Somerville to go. That's the kind of place tonight where it's always popular with locals, but you can probably walk in and just get a place at the bar. Union Square in Somerville, if you happen to find it, like where the last four restaurants I've reviewed in Boston Magazine are, because everybody's opening restaurants there.
Yeah, Union Square is really hot and up and coming. It's terrific.
Right. So if you go there, or if you go where I mentioned Area 4 in Somerville, yeah. Or an incredible special occasion place people don't think of often enough, it's called Salt, and it's right across from the center of the universe, Toscanini's, which is great ice cream, and I'm sure they're plenty crowded today on Main Street in Cambridge. Salt is run by a husband and wife team, really excellent European/new American food. That's a lovely special occasion restaurant, and I bet you'll be able to get in just by going in. It's a short walk across the MIT Bridge.
By the way, Toscanini's, for those who don't know, all homemade ice cream, and it is just spectacular. You know, Corby, I hesitate to say this because every time I mention that I ran two marathons, Marjorie makes a face that I'm just doing self-promotion.
He mentions it about
okay.
20 times.
I have duty today to mention every 15
okay,
minutes.
Okay, fine. Yeah. I'm going to mention, I don't think I have time for more than two or three more mentions before the end of the special three-hour edition. And why don't you ask me, Marjorie, where did I go after the two marathons I finished?
Where did you go, Jim, after
I went,
the two
thank
marathons.
You for asking.
You're
I went
welcome.
To the Carnegie Deli
oh.
in New York City, my favorite restaurant in the world. Could you explain to us, I know this is not directly on topic, but I've been wanting to ask you this for ages, and I keep forgetting every time you're in the studio. Why is there not a good Jewish deli that can last in Boston?
I think it's because there's not enough knowledge of what good deli is that would build demand for it. So when you think of somebody like David Chang of the Momofuku Empire I've just been talking about, that in its way pays homage to the idea of cured salted meat. When you think of the roasted pork shoulder that Momofuku made famous, which is incredibly succulent and moist and could taste like a cross between pastrami and corned beef because it's this delicious meat that has been quite heavily spiced in advance. So there's a new evolution of what we thought of as deli food, but as far as slicing it into sandwiches, there's Parish Cafe here. But that food is considered retrograde and heavy. Chicken fat and knishes. When you think of what people happily tuck into, which is pork belly, pure fat, all kinds of different kinds of pork, which are, of course, very treif, meaning not kosher, but it's the same idea of very rich, succulent, soft, long-cooked, spiced meat. They just don't realize that that's part of an honorable deli tradition, and they won't go for it. When I find clear chicken soup that has lots of broth in it, I think that Tim Maslow at Rebelli does one, I will like celebrate it because what is it? It's an evocation of chicken soup and the matzo balls that a lot of us had last week at our many staters.
Okay, but last question relating to that, if we can, Corby Kummer. So the Carnegie Deli, which I would argue is the best deli in the world, outside of which there is always a 30-minute to 1-hour line. It's the only line in America that I will actually stand in. If the Carnegie Deli could be transported exactly as is, with the same rude staff, the same rushing waiters, exactly as is, and plopped down somewhere in Boston, would it be a success?
You know, only if it paid homage to some kind of Boston tradition.
Yeah.
Because we like rude, right? Durgan Park is famous for its rudeness.
Point.
We can go for rude, but it's got to create its own local cult. So probably not.
Well, I am the cult. I am the one-man cult, and I'm waiting for that day. Hey, Corby, it's a pleasure to talk to you, as always.
As always.
Thank you very much, and as always, he has made me very hungry after talking with Corby Kammer. Thank you very much, Corby.
Okay, thank you.
Fun to talk to you. Corby Kammer is a senior editor at The Atlantic and an award-winning food writer. Great to talk to you. And I think we're going to take some calls.
We're going to take some calls as soon as we get back. Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to take some calls. When we come back at 877-301-8970, you're listening to Boston Public Radio. He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Marco Werman. PRI's The World brings you more than just a day's news.
Well, the poor old British pub has been around for 2,000 years.
We introduce you to people around the globe.
I'm a Liberian, but I'm part of Africa.
If we were only in Argentina.
I think it's a Scottish thing, you know? This sense of doom there, but it's always kind of amusing to us.
Join us and hear The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Merrimack Repertory Theater, presenting the Reduced Shakespeare Company in The Complete History of Comedy, Abridged, April 24th to May 18th. More information and tickets available at mrt.org. And State Street, partnering with institutional investors worldwide to create the way ahead. Proud to support Innovation Hub, Saturday at 10 a.m. and in the Innovation Block each Thursday at 9 p.m. on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. You're listening to a special three-hour edition of Boston Public Radio in honor of Marathon Day. We have a handful of minutes left. We'll take some calls, all things marathon that make you move. And you got to remind me, by the way, sometime later this week, we have to have the discussion we have with Corby Kammer at the end. Why is there not a good Jewish delicatessen in Boston? And would a good Jewish delicatessen survive and prosper in 2014.
They used to have that good place, the B&D on Beacon Street.
Yeah,
in
there
Brooklyn,
is. Okay, it's fine.
But it shut down.
It's fine.
They got Rubens
near the
and
Starbucks.
Harvard Street.
It's fine. There are a couple
it's fine.
Of... fine.
Okay.
Not good enough. 877, trust me, 877-301-8970. What's the takeaway from the day? I assume the headline beyond Boston is going to be that an American man finally wins the race. He won Mev Kavleski. I hope I got it right. My apologies if I did get it wrong. He won. There had not been a male winner since 1983.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big deal.
Well, Art just emailed. He was saying we had to poach citizens from another country. So
well, it's true.
An American could win.
But he is a proud American, and we're happy.
He's American.
He won.
That's good
he
enough.
He is American. That's exactly right. 877-301-8970. Anything moves you about this particular day, please share it with us in the remaining minutes we have. Kevin, you're in Brookline. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, I love you both a lot, and
thanks.
I have to say that a year ago on the 15th, I was in Los Angeles in a hospital, and my mom had cancer, and I just told the doctors that it was okay to put her in comfort care and essentially end her life as painlessly as possible.
Oh.
And my phone buzzed, and there was a text from my girlfriend, Amy Beth, who's sitting next to me, telling me that her parents were at ground zero at the marathon, and there had been a bombing, which obviously astounded me. And thankfully, both of her parents turned out to be okay. They saved her mom's leg and have been all the survivor things, Michael and Beth, and all the support groups, and it's just been fantastic. And I got to watch Los Angeles be riveted by Boston last year, and I saw Newton Cops that I knew on TV constantly. And so the whole thing this year, I was shocked at how cathartic it was for me as well. And just to see how amazing our city was. And, you know, I was lucky enough to attend all the tribute things with Annie and her folks. And then the marathon today, it also took a different type of weight off of my shoulders just to see how fantastic everybody was. So Boston Strong isn't a slogan, it's a reality. It really is.
That's beautifully
Thank
put,
you,
Kevin.
Kevin.
That was great.
Thank you for that great call. Let's go to Barbara in Sandwich. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Marjorie. I want you to know you're not the only one to reward yourself with a cigarette. I ran the East Lyme Marathon in 1981, and I ran Boston in 1983, and I faithfully trained with a runner's world training schedule for 4 months, but I would come home from my Sunday long run and reward myself with a cigarette and a
beer. There you go. You know, I mean, you just can't overdo these things, Barbara, right?
By the way, while you connected to her via the cigarette thing, when you said what you just said, Barbara, which I had totally forgotten about, that's how in the early boom of running, that's how we all trained. I forgot. We bought Runner's World. We subscribed to Runner's World, and we all religiously followed the training regimen because there was no internet, and we had no idea what we were doing.
And they were just bringing in the first running bras at that time, too, Barbara, as I recall, right?
Listen to Barbara.
Yeah, I remember those contraptions you'd have to do by yourself to get through the race. It wasn't easy.
Barbara, thanks for the call. The cigarette connection you're not doing it now, except after a drink.
No,
correct?
I don't smoke anymore. Every once in a while.
No, but you
maybe
said
New
why?
Year's
why
Eve.
Don't you smoke, Marjorie?
Well, because I quit. You know, years
no,
ago.
No, what's the other reason?
Well, there's no one to bum them off.
Exactly,
you
as you said.
You go to parties and you're celebrating, especially in the summertime on vacation. Have a couple of cocktails,
live
but
longer.
So few people smoke anymore that there's no one to bum them off of anymore. Anyway, Jim in the car. Thank you for calling. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Jim.
Hey, how you doing?
We're great. Excellent. Thanks for calling.
Hey, listen, born and bred New Yorker here. Very happy to tell you and your viewers, listeners, that, in fact, there is a great Jewish deli in Boston.
Which one?
With corned beef, pastrami, knishes, every bit as good as Carnegie Deli. It's called Michael's Deli.
I've been there.
Oh!
Beacon Street, right at College Corner.
College Corner. I no disrespect intended to Michael's, nor to you, Jim. I like it. I think it's quite good. But there's Carnegie Delicatessen, and then there's all the rest. I'm stunned that you put it in the same. You really on the same level, or is just the best in town?
Well, maybe you know, it certainly doesn't have the atmosphere. Actually, my favorite Jewish deli in the world is in Baltimore. It's called Atman's.
Never heard of it.
But
never been there.
Anyway, it's the best thing we got going here. So enjoy
now,
it.
How about Jim? We just got an email from Scott saying Zoftig's on Harvard Street.
Zoftig's
in Brookline
is fine.
Is really
there's another
good
Zoftig's
too.
Also on Route 9. It's good, Jim. Thanks for the call. Do you remember years ago? Two pretty famous lawyers, Harvey Silverglate, mm-hmm. Alan Dershowitz, and a bunch of other very prominent defense lawyers opened the Jewish Deli in Harvard Square, which everybody thought was going to be the deli to end all delis, and it didn't last terribly long.
You know, I'm going to let a little secret out of the bag.
What's
here.
That?
Norma just emailed. Apparently, Jim, lots of people, including Norma, hear you always calling me Marguerite, as with a hard G.
Here we go again.
We don't know why it's happening, everybody that hears this. It sounds like Marjorie to me. It sounds like Marjorie to everybody in our production team. But Norma, you are not alone. Everybody says that. Why does
Here's what you
got
to do. They have to do it. They have to email us exactly at the moment they hear it and tell us the time, and we will go back to the tape and identify.
Yeah,
it's a mystery.
That's right. Norma, he doesn't mean to annoy you and everybody else he's annoying.
Marguerite, the show's over. That was a joke, everybody.
Okay. Thank you very much for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Nancy Kane. We'll get her take on Earth Day, plus gubernatorial candidate Charlie Baker will be here.
And by the way, you heard in the middle of their race today, Doctors Joe and Natalie Stavis, father and daughter, joined us mid-race to call in. They're going to be on Greater Boston tonight with Emily Rooney. And by the way, they have great stories to tell, not just about today, but about what they did last year after the bombing.
Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. Our team, Chelsea Murris, Will Roselip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan. I am Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in.